press those who have assembled to catch a glimpse of the renowned Dragon Rider. Her eyes twinkled with suppressed merriment. Me? It is expected. Then Aragorn turned and faced the multitude, his tongue dry as sand. His mind was blank, and for a handful of panic-stricken seconds he thought the use of language would continue to elude him, and he would embarrass himself in front of the entire Varden. Somewhere a horse nickered, but otherwise the camp seemed frightfully quiet. It was Saphira who broke his paralysis by nudging his elbow with her snout and saying,
"Tell them how honored you are to have their support, and how happy you are to be back among them."
With her encouragement, he managed to find a few fumbling words, and then, as soon as it was acceptable, he bowed and retreated a step. Forcing a smile, while the Varden clapped and cheered and beat their swords against their shields, he exclaimed, "That was horrible. I would rather fight a shade than do that again."
"Really? It was not that hard, Aragorn?"
"Yes, it was." A puff of smoke drifted up from her nostrils as she snorted with amusement.
"A fine dragon rider you are, afraid of talking to a large group. If only Galbatorix knew. He could have you at his mercy if he but asked you to make a speech to his troops. Ha!"
"It's not funny," he grumbled. But she still continued to chuckle. To answer a king. After Aragorn gave his address to the Varden, Nasuada gestured, and Jormunda leaped to her side. "Have everyone here return to their posts. If we were attacked now, we would be overwhelmed."
"Yes, my lady."
Beckoning to Aragorn and Arya, Nasuada placed her left hand on King Orin's arm, and with him entered the pavilion.
"What about you?"
Aragorn asked Saphira as he followed. Then he stepped inside the pavilion and saw that a panel at the back had been rolled up and tied to the wooden frame above, so that Saphira might insert her head and participate in the goings-on. He had to wait but a moment before her glittering head and neck swung into view around the edge of the opening, darkening the interior as she settled into place. Purple flecks of light adorned the walls, projected by her blue scales onto the red fabric. Aragorn examined the rest of the tent. It was barren compared with when he had last visited, a result of the destruction Saphira had caused when she crawled into the pavilion to see Aragorn in Nasuada's mirror. With only 4 pieces of furniture, the tent was austere, even by military standards. There was the polished, high-backed chair where Nasuada was sitting, King Orin standing next to her. The self-same mirror, which was mounted at eye level on a carved brass pole. A folding chair, and a low table strewn with maps and other documents of import. An intricately knotted dwarf rug covered the ground. Besides Arya and himself, a score of people were already gathered before Nasuada. They were all looking at him. Among them he recognized Nahim, the current commander of the dwarf troops. Triana and other spellcasters from Duvrangar Gata. Sabre, Umerth, and the rest of the Council of Elders save for Jormunda, and a random assortment of nobles and functionaries from King Orin's court. Those who were strangers to him, he assumed also held positions of distinction in one of the many factions that made up the Varden's army. 6 of Nasuada's guards were present, 2 stationed by the entrance and 4 behind Nasuada, and Aragorn detected the convoluted pattern of Elva's dark and twisted thoughts from where the witch-child was hidden at the far end of the pavilion.
"Aragorn," said Nasuada, "you have not met before, but let me introduce Sagabato no Inapashunna Fadawa, chief of the Inapashunna tribe. He is a brave man."
For the next hour, Aragorn endured what seemed like an endless procession of introductions, congratulations, and questions that he could not answer forthrightly without revealing secrets that were better left unsaid. When all of the guests had conversed with him, Nasuada bade them take their leave. As they filed out of the pavilion, she clapped her hands and the guards outside ushered in a second group. And then, when the second group had enjoyed the dubious fruits of their visitation with him, a third. Aragorn smiled the whole while. He shook hand after hand, he exchanged meaningless pleasantries, and strove to memorize the plethora of names and titles that besieged him, and otherwise acted with perfect civility the role he was expected to play. He knew that they honored him not because he was their friend, but because of the chance of victory he embodied for the free peoples of Alagaesia, because of his power, and because of what they hoped to gain by him. In his heart he howled with frustration and longed to break free of the stifling constraints of good manners and polite conduct, and to climb on Saphira and fly away to somewhere peaceful. The one part of the process Aragorn enjoyed was watching how the supplicants reacted to the two Urgals who loomed behind Nasawada's chair. Some pretended to ignore the horned warriors, although from the quickness of their motions and the shrill tones of their voices, Aragorn could tell that the creatures unnerved them, while others glared at the Urgals and kept their hands on the pommels of their swords or daggers, and still others affected a false bravado and belittled the Urgals' notorious strength and boasted of their own. Only a few people truly seemed unaffected by the sight of the Urgals. Foremost among them was Nasawada, but their number also included King Orin, Triana, and an earl who said he had seen Morzan and his dragon lay waste to an entire town when he had been but a boy. When Aragorn could bear no more, Saphira swelled her chest and released a low, humming growl, so deep that it shook the mirror in its frame. The pavilion became as silent as a tomb. Her growl was not overtly threatening, but it captured everyone's attention and proclaimed her impatience with the proceedings. None of the guests were foolish enough to test her forbearance. With hurried excuses, they gathered their things and filed out of the pavilion, quickening their pace when Saphira tapped the tips of her claws against the ground. Nasawada sighed as the entrance flap swung closed behind the last visitor.
"Thank you, Saphira. I am sorry that I had to subject you to the misery of public presentation, Aragorn. But as I am sure you are aware, you occupy an exalted position among the Varden, and I cannot keep you to myself any more. You belong to the people now. They demand that you recognize them, and that you give them what they consider their rightful share of your time. Neither you, nor Orin, nor I can refuse the wishes of the crowd. Even Galbatorix, in his dark seat of power at Urubane, fears the fickle crowd, although he may deny it to everyone, including himself." With the guests departed, King Orin abandoned the guise of royal decorum. His stern expression relaxed into one of more human relief, irritation, and ferocious curiosity. Rolling his shoulders beneath his stiff robes, he looked at Nasawada and said, "I do not think we require your nighthawks to wait on us any longer."
"Agreed."
Nasawada clapped her hands, dismissing the six guards from the inside of the tent. Dragging the spare chair over to Nasawada's, King Orin seated himself in a tangle of sprawling limbs and billowing fabric. "Now," he said, switching his gaze between Aragorn and Arya, "let us have a full account of your doings, Aragorn Shadeslayer. I have heard only vague explanations for why you chose to delay at Helgrind, and I've had my fill of evasions and deceptive answers. I am determined to know the truth of the matter, so I warn you, do not attempt to conceal what actually transpired while you were in the Empire. Until I am satisfied you have told me everything there is to tell, none of us shall so much as step outside of this tent." Her voice cold, Nasawada said,
"You assume too much, Your Majesty. You do not have the authority to bind me in place, nor Aragorn, who is my vassal, nor Saphira, nor Arya, who answers to no mortal lord, but rather to one more powerful than the two of us combined.
nor do we have the authority to bind you. The five of us are as close to equals as any of us is likely to find in Alagazia. You would do well to remember that." King Orin's response was equally flinty. "Do I exceed the bounds of my sovereignty? Well, perhaps I do. You are right. I have no hold over you. However, if we are equals, I have yet to see evidence of it in your treatment of me. Aragorn answers to you, and only you. By the trial of the Long Knives, you have gained dominion over the wandering tribes, many of which I have long counted among my subjects. And you command as you will both the Varden and the men of Cirda, who have long served my family with bravery and determination beyond that of ordinary men. It was you yourself who asked me to orchestrate this campaign," said Nasawada. "I have not deposed you." "Aye, it was at my request you assumed command of our disparate forces. I am not ashamed to admit you have had more experience and success than I in waging war. Our prospects are too precarious for you, me, or any of us to indulge in false pride. However, since your investiture, you seem to have forgotten that I am still the King of Cirda, and we of the Langfeld family can trace our line back to Thanebrand the Ringgiver himself, he who succeeded old mad Palancar, and who was the first of our race to sit on the throne in what is now Urubane. Considering our heritage, and the assistance the House of Langfeld has rendered you in this cause, it is insulting of you to ignore the rights of my office. You act as if yours was the only verdict of moment, and the opinions of others are of no account, to be trampled over in pursuit of whatever goal you have already determined is best for the portion of free humanity that is fortunate enough to have you as their leader. You negotiate treaties and alliances such as that with the Urgals of your own initiative, and expect me and others to abide by your decisions as if you speak for us all. You arrange preemptive visits of state, such as that with Blodgarm Voda, and do not trouble to alert me of his arrival, nor wait for me to join you so we might greet his embassy together as equals. And when I have the temerity to ask why Aragorn, the man whose very existence is the reason I have staked my country in this venture, when I have the temerity to ask why this all-important person has elected to endanger the lives of Cirdans and those of every creature who opposes Galbatorix by tarrying in the midst of our enemies, how is it you respond? By treating me as if I were no more than an overzealous, over-inquisitive underling whose childish concerns distracted you from more pressing matters. Bah! I will not have it, I tell you. If you cannot bring yourself to respect my station and to accept a fair division of responsibility as two allies ought to, then it is my opinion that you are unfit to command a coalition such as ours, and I shall set myself against you, however I may.
What a long-winded fellow,
Saphira observed. Alarmed by the direction the conversation had taken, Aragorn said, What should I do? I had not intended to tell anyone else about Sloane except for Nasawada. The fewer people who know he's alive, the better. A flickering sea-blue shimmer ran from the base of Saphira's head to the crest of her shoulders, as the tips of the sharp, diamond-shaped scales along the sides of her neck rose a fraction of an inch from the underlying skin. The jagged layers of projecting scales gave her a fierce, ruffled appearance.
I cannot tell you what is best, Aragorn. In this, you must rely upon your own judgment. Listen closely to what your heart says, and perhaps it will become clear how to win free of these treacherous downdrafts.
In response to King Orin's sally, Nasawada clasped her hands in her lap, her bandages startling white against the green of her dress, and in a calm, even voice said,
If I have slighted you, sire, then it was due to my own hasty carelessness, and not to any desire on my part to diminish you or your house. Please forgive my lapses. They shall not happen again, that I promise you. As you have pointed out, I have but recently ascended to this post, and I have yet to master all of the accompanying niceties.
Orin inclined his head in a cool but gracious acceptance of her words.
As for Aragorn and his activities in the Empire, I could not have provided you with specific details, for I have had no further intelligence myself. It was not, as I am sure you can appreciate, a situation that I wished to advertise.
No, of course not.
Therefore it seems to me that the swiftest cure for the dispute that afflicts us is to allow Aragorn to lay bare the facts of his trip, that we may apprehend the full scope of this event and render judgment upon it.
Of its own, that is not a cure, said King Orin. But it is the beginning of a cure, and I will gladly listen.
Then let us tarry no longer, said Nasawada. Let us begin this beginning, and have done with our suspense. Aragorn, it is time for your tale.
With Nasawada and the others gazing at him with wondering eyes, Aragorn made his choice. Lifting his chin, he said, What I tell you in confidence. I know I cannot expect either you, King Orin, or you, Lady Nasawada, to swear that you will keep this secret bound within your hearts from now until the day you die, but I beg you to act as if you had. It could cause a great deal of grief if this knowledge were to be whispered in the wrong ears.
A king does not remain king for long, unless he appreciates the value of silence, said Orin.
Without further ado, Aragorn described everything that had happened to him in Helgrind, and in the days that had followed. Afterward, Arya explained how she had gone about locating Aragorn, and then corroborated his account of their travels by providing several facts and observations of her own. When they had both said their fill, the pavilion was quiet, as Orin and Nasawada sat motionless upon their chairs. Aragorn felt as if he were a child again, waiting for Garrow to tell him what his punishment would be for doing something foolish on their farm. Orin and Nasawada remained lost, deep in reflection, for several minutes. Then Nasawada smoothed the front of her dress and said,
King Orin may be of a different opinion, and if so, I look forward to hearing his reasons. But for my part, I believe that you did the right thing, Aragorn.
As do I, said Orin, surprising them all.
You do?
Exclaimed Aragorn. He hesitated.
I don't mean to sound impertinent, for I'm glad you approve. But I didn't expect you to look kindly upon my decision to spare Sloane's life. If I may ask, why?
King Orin interrupted.
Why do we approve? The rule of law must be upheld. If you had appointed yourself Sloane's executioner, Aragorn, you would have taken for yourself the power that Nasawada and I wield. For he who has the audacity to determine who should live and who should die no longer serves the law, but dictates the law. And however benevolent you might be, that would be no good thing for our species. Nasuada and I at least answer to the one lord even kings must kneel before. We answer to Angvard in his realm of eternal twilight. We answer to the grey man on his grey horse, Death. We could be the worst tyrants in the whole of history, and given enough time, Angvard would bring us to heel. But not you. Humans are a short-lived race, and we should not be governed by one of the undying. We do not need another Galbatorix.
A strange laugh escaped from Orin then, and his mouth twisted in a humorless smile.
Do you understand, Aragorn? You are so dangerous. We are forced to acknowledge the danger to your face and hope that you are one of the few people able to resist the lure of power.
King Orin laced his fingers together underneath his chin and gazed at a fold in his robes.
I have said more than I intended. So, for all those reasons and others besides, I agree with Nasuada. You were right
to stay your hand when you discovered this Sloane in Hellgrind. As inconvenient as this episode has been, it would have been far worse, and for you as well, if you had killed to please yourself, and not in self-defense or in service to others." Nasawada nodded.
"That was well spoken."
Throughout, Arya listened with an inscrutable expression. Whatever her own thoughts on the matter were, she did not divulge them. Orin and Nasawada pressed Aragorn with a number of questions about the oaths he had laid upon Sloane, as well as queries about the remainder of his trip. The interrogation continued for so long, Nasawada had a tray of cool cider, fruit and meat pies brought into the pavilion, along with a haunch of a steer for Saphira. Nasawada and Orin had ample opportunity to eat between questions. However, they kept Aragorn so busy talking, he managed to consume only 2 bites of fruit and a few sips of cider to wet his throat. At long last, King Orin bade them farewell, and departed to review the status of his cavalry. Arya left a minute later, explaining that she needed to report to Queen Islanzadi, and to, as she said,
"heat a tub of water, wash the sand from my skin, and return my features to their usual shape. I do not feel myself, with the tips of my ears missing, my eyes round and level, and the bones of my face in the wrong places."
When she was alone with Aragorn and Saphira, Nasawada sighed and leaned her head against the back of the chair. Aragorn was shocked by how tired she appeared. Gone were her previous vitality and strength of presence. Gone was the fire from her eyes. She had, he realized, been pretending to be stronger than she was in order to avoid tempting her enemies and demoralizing the Varden with the spectacle of her weakness.
"Are you ill?" he asked.
She nodded toward her arms.
"Not exactly. It's taking me longer to recuperate than I had anticipated. Some days are worse than others."
"If you want, I can—"
"No, thank you, but no. Do not tempt me. One rule of the Trial of the Long Knives is that you must allow your wounds to heal at their own pace, without magic. Otherwise, the contestants will not have endured the full measure of pain from their cuts."
"That's barbaric." A slow smile touched her lips.
"Maybe so, but it is what it is. And I would not fail so late in the trial, merely because I could not withstand a bit of an ache."
"What if your wounds fester?"
"Then they fester, and I shall pay the price for my mistake. But I doubt they will, while Angela ministers to me. She has an amazing storehouse of knowledge where medicinal plants are concerned. I half believe she could tell you the true name of every species of grass on the plains east of here, merely by feeling their leaves."
Saphira, who had been so still she appeared asleep, now yawned, nearly touching the floor and the ceiling with the tips of her open jaws, and shook her head and neck, sending the flecks of light reflected by her scales spinning about the tent with dizzying speed. Straightening in her seat, Nasawada said,
"Ah, I am sorry. I know this has been tedious. You have both been very patient. Thank you."
Aragorn knelt and placed his right hand over hers. "You do not need to worry about me, Nasawada. I know my duty. I have never aspired to rule. That is not my destiny. And if ever I am offered the chance to sit upon a throne, I shall refuse and see that it goes to someone who is better suited than I to lead our race."
"You are a good person, Aragorn," murmured Nasawada,
and pressed his hand between hers. Then she chuckled.
"What with you, Roran and Murtagh, I seem to spend most of my time worrying about members of your family."
Aragorn bridled at the statement. "Murtagh is no family of mine."
"Of course, forgive me. But still, you must admit, it's startling how much bother the three of you have caused both the Empire and the Varden."
"It's a talent of ours," joked Aragorn.
"It runs in their blood," said Saphira. "Wherever they go, they get themselves entangled in the worst danger possible."
She nudged Aragorn in the arm.
"Especially this one. What else can you expect of people from Palancar Valley? Descendants all of a mad king!
But not mad themselves, said Nasawada. At least I don't think so. It's hard to tell at times. She laughed. If you, Roran, and Murtagh were locked in the same cell, I'm not sure who would survive.
Aragorn laughed as well.
Roran! He's not about to let a little thing like death stand between him and Katrina.
Nasawada's smile became slightly strained.
No, I suppose he wouldn't at that.
For a score of heartbeats she was silent. Then,
goodness me, how selfish I am! The day is almost done, and here I am detaining you, merely so I can enjoy a minute or two of idle conversation.
The pleasure is mine.
Yes, but there are better places than this for talk among friends. After what you have been through, I expect you would like a wash, a change, and a hearty meal, no? You must be famished.
Aragorn glanced at the apple he still held, and regretfully concluded it would be impolite to continue eating it when his audience with Nasawada was drawing to a close. Nasawada caught his look and said,
Your face answers for you, Shadeslayer. You have the guise of a winter-starved wolf. Well, I shall not torment you any longer. Go and bathe, and garb yourself in your finest tunic. When you are presentable, I would be most pleased if you would consent to join me for my evening meal. Understand, you would not be my only guest, for the affairs of the Varden demand my constant attention, but you would brighten the proceedings considerably for me, if you chose to attend.
Aragorn fought back a grimace at the thought of having to spend hours more parrying verbal thrusts from those who sought to use him for their own advantage, or to satisfy their curiosity about riders and dragons. Still, Nasawada was not to be denied, so he bowed and agreed to her request.
A Feast with Friends. Aragorn and Saphira left Nasawada's crimson pavilion, with the contingent of elves ranged about them, and walked to the small tent that had been assigned to him when they had joined the Varden at the Burning Plains. There he found a hogshead of boiling water waiting for him, the coils of steam opalescent in the oblique light from the large evening sun. Ignoring it for the moment, he ducked inside the tent. After checking to ensure that none of his few possessions had been disturbed during his absence, Aragorn unburdened himself of his pack and carefully removed his armor, storing it beneath his cot. It needed to be wiped and oiled, but that was a task that would have to wait. Then he reached even farther underneath the cot, his fingers scraping the fabric wall beyond, and groped in the darkness until his hand came into contact with a long, hard object. Grasping it, he lay the heavy cloth-wrapped bundle across his knees. He picked apart the knots in the wrapping, and then, starting at the thickest end of the bundle, began to unwind the coarse strips of canvas. Inch by inch, the scuffed leather hilt of Murtagh's hand-and-a-half sword came into view. Aragorn stopped when he had exposed the hilt, the crossguard, and a fair expanse of the gleaming blade, which was as jagged as a saw, from where Murtagh had blocked Aragorn's blows with Zarok. Aragorn sat and stared at the weapon, conflicted. He did not know what had prompted him, but the day after the battle, he had returned to the plateau and retrieved the sword from the morass of trampled dirt where Murtagh had dropped it. Even after only a single night exposed to the elements, the steel had acquired a mottled veil of rust. With a word, he had dispelled the scrim of corrosion. Perhaps it was because Murtagh had stolen his own sword that Aragorn felt compelled to take up Murtagh's, as if the exchange, unequal and involuntary though it was, minimized his loss. Perhaps it was because he wished to claim a memento of that bloody conflict. And perhaps it was because he still harbored a sense of latent affection for Murtagh, despite the grim circumstances that had turned them against each other. No matter how much Aragorn abhorred what Murtagh had become, and pitied him for it too, he could not deny the connection that existed between them. Theirs was a shared fate. If not for an accident of birth, he would have been raised in Urabain,
and Murtag in Palancar Valley, and then their current positions might well have been reversed. Their lives were inexorably intertwined. As he gazed at the silver steel, Aragorn composed a spell that would smooth the wrinkles from the blade, close the wedge-shaped gaps along the edges, and restore the strength of the temper. He wondered, however, if he ought to. The scar that Durza had given him, he had kept as a reminder of their encounter, at least until the dragons erased it during the Agaiti Blodron. Should he keep this scar as well, then? Would it be healthy for him to carry such a painful memory on his hip? And what sort of message would it send to the rest of the Varden, if he chose to wield the blade of another betrayer? Zarok had been a gift from Brom. Aragorn could not have refused to accept it, nor was he sorry he had. But he was under no such compulsion to claim as his own the nameless blade that rested upon his thighs. "I need a sword," he thought, "but not this sword." He wrapped the blade again in its shroud of canvas and slid it back under the cot. Then, with a fresh shirt and tunic tucked under his elbow, he left the tent and went to bathe. When he was clean and garbed in the fine Lamare shirt and tunic, he set out to meet with Nasuada near the tents of the healers, as she had requested. Saphira flew, for as she said,
"It is too cramped for me on the ground. I keep knocking over tents. Besides, if I walk with you, such a herd of people will gather around us, we will hardly be able to move."
Nasawada was waiting for him by a row of three flagpoles, upon which a half-dozen gaudy pennants hung limp in the cooling air. She had changed since they had parted, and now wore a light summer frock, the colour of pale straw. Her dense, moss-like hair she had piled high on her head in an intricate mass of knots and braids. A single white ribbon held the arrangement in place. She smiled at Aragorn. He smiled in return and quickened his pace. As he drew close, his guards mingled with her guards, with a conspicuous display of suspicion on the part of the Nighthawks, and studied indifference on the part of the elves. Nasawada took his arm, and while they spoke in comfortable tones, guided his steps as they ambled through the sea of tents. Above, Saphira circled the camp, content to wait until they arrived at their destination, before she went to the effort of landing. Aragorn and Nasawada spoke of many things. Little of consequence passed between their lips, but her wit, her gaiety, and the thoughtfulness of her remarks charmed him. It was easy for him to talk to her, and easier to listen. And that very ease caused him to realize how much he cared for her. Her hold on him far exceeded that of a liege lord over her vassal. It was a new feeling for him, their bond. Aside from his Aunt Marion, of whom he had but faint memories, he had grown up in a world of men and boys, and he had never had the opportunity to be friends with a woman. His inexperience made him uncertain, and his uncertainty made him awkward. But Nasawada did not seem to notice. She stopped him before a tent that glowed from within with the light of many candles and that hummed with a multitude of unintelligible voices. "Now we must dive into the swamp of politics again. Prepare yourself." She swept back the entrance flap to the tent, and Aragorn jumped as a host of people shouted, "Surprise!" A wide trestle table laden with food dominated the center of the tent, and at the table were sitting Roran and Katrina, 20 or so of the villagers from Carvajal, including Horst and his family, Angela the herbalist, Jode and his wife Helen, and several people Aragorn did not recognize, but who had the look of sailors. A half-dozen children had been playing on the ground next to the table. They paused in their games and stared at Nasawada and Aragorn with open mouths, seemingly unable to decide which of these two strange figures deserved more of their attention. Aragorn grinned, overwhelmed. Before he could think of what to say, Angela raised her flagon and piped, "Well, don't just stand there gaping. Come in, sit down. I'm hungry." As everyone laughed, Nasawada pulled Aragorn toward the two empty chairs next to Roran. Aragorn helped Nasawada to her seat, and as she sank into the chair, he asked,
"Did you arrange this?" "Rohan suggested whom you might want to attend, but yes, the original idea was mine, and I made a few additions of my own to the table, as you can see."
"Thank you," said Aragorn, humbled. "Thank you so much." He saw Elva, sitting cross-legged in the far left corner of the tent, a platter of food on her lap. The other children shunned her. Aragorn could not imagine they had much in common, and none of the adults, save Angela, seemed comfortable in her presence. The small, narrow-shouldered girl gazed up at him from under her black bangs, with her horrible violet eyes, and mouthed what he guessed was, "Greetings, Shade Slayer." "Greetings, Farseer," he mouthed in return. Her small, pink lips parted in what would have been a charming smile, if not for the fell orbs that burned above them. Aragorn gripped the arms of his chair as the table shook, the dishes rattled, and the walls of the tent flapped. Then the back of the tent bulged and parted as Saphira pushed her head inside.
"Meat,"
she said.
"I smell meat."
For the next few hours, Aragorn lost himself in a blur of food, drink, and the pleasure of good company. It was like returning home. The wine flowed like water, and after they had drained their cups once or twice, the villagers forgot their deference and treated him as one of their own, which was the greatest gift they could give. They were equally generous with Nasawada, although they refrained from making jokes at her expense, as they sometimes did with Aragorn. Pale smoke filled the tent as the candles consumed themselves. Beside him, Aragorn heard the boom of Rohan's laughter ring forth again and again, and across the table the even deeper boom of Horst's laugh. Muttering an incantation, Angela set to dancing a small man she had fashioned from a crust of sourdough bread, much to everyone's amusement. The children gradually overcame their fear of Saphira and dared to walk up to her and pet her snout. Soon they were clambering over her neck, hanging from her spikes, and tugging at the crests above her eyes. Aragorn laughed as he watched. Jode entertained the crowd with a song he had learnt from a book long ago. Tara danced a jig. Nasuwara's teeth flashed as she tossed her head back. And Aragorn, by popular request, recounted several of his adventures, including a detailed description of his flight from Carvajal with Brom, which was of special interest to his listeners. "To think," said Gertrude, the round-faced healer, tugging on her shawl, "we had a dragon in our valley and we never even knew it." With a pair of knitting needles produced from within her sleeves, she pointed at Aragorn. "To think I nursed you when your legs had been scraped from flying on Saphira, and I never suspected the cause." Shaking her head and clucking her tongue, she cast on with brown wool yarn and began to knit with a speed born of decades of practice. Elaine was the first to leave the party, pleading exhaustion brought on by her advanced stage of pregnancy. One of her sons, Baldur, went with her. Half an hour later, Nasawada also made to leave, explaining that the demands of her position prevented her from staying as long as she would like, but that she wished them health and happiness, and hoped they would continue to support her in her fight against the Empire. As she moved away from the table, Nasawada beckoned to Aragorn. He joined her by the entrance. Turning her shoulder to the rest of the tent, she said,
"Aragorn, I know that you need time to recover from your journey, and that you have affairs of your own that you must tend to. Therefore, tomorrow and the day after are yours to spend as you will. But on the morning of the third day, present yourself at my pavilion, and we shall talk about your future. I have a most important mission for you."
"My lady." Then he said, "You keep Elva close at hand wherever you go, do you not?"
"Aye. She is my safeguard against any danger that might slip past the Nighthawks. Also, her ability to divine what it is that pains people has proved enormously helpful. It is so much easier to obtain someone's cooperation when you are privy to all of their secret hurts."
"Are you willing to give that up?" She studied him with a piercing gaze.
You intend to remove your curse from Elva?
I intend to try. Remember, I promised her I would.
Yes, I was there.
The crash of a falling chair distracted her for an instant. Then she said,
Your promises will be the death of us. Elva is irreplaceable. No one else has her skill. And the service she provides, as I just testified, is worth more than a mountain of gold. I have even thought that of all of us, she alone might be able to defeat Galbatorix. She would be able to anticipate his every attack, and your spell would show her how to counter them. And as long as countering them did not require her to sacrifice her life, she would prevail. For the good of the Varden, Aragorn, for the good of everyone in Alagaesia, couldn't you feign your attempt to cure Elva?
No, he said, biting off the word as if it offended him. I would not do it, even if I could.
It would be wrong. If we force Elva to remain as she is, she will turn against us, and I do not want her as an enemy.
He paused. Then, at Nasawada's expression, added,
Besides, there is a good chance I may not succeed. Removing such a vaguely worded spell is a difficult prospect at best. If I may make a suggestion.
What? Be honest with Elva. Explain to her what she means to the Varden, and ask her if she will continue to carry her burden for the sake of all free people. She may refuse, she has every right to, but if she does, her character is not one we would want to rely upon anyway. And if she accepts, then it shall be of her own free will.
With a slight frown, Nasawada nodded.
I shall speak with her tomorrow. You should be present as well, to help me persuade her, and to lift your curse if we fail. Be at my pavilion 3 hours after dawn.
And with that, she swept into the torch-lit night outside. Much later, when the candles guttered in their sockets, and the villagers began to disperse in twos and threes, Roran grasped Aragorn's arm by the elbow, and drew him through the back of the tent to stand by Saphira's side, where the others could not hear. What you said earlier about Helgrind, was that all of it? Asked Roran. His grip was like a pair of iron pincers clamped around Aragorn's flesh. His eyes were hard and questioning, and also unusually vulnerable. Aragorn held his gaze.
If you trust me, Roran, never ask me that question again. It's not something you want to know.
Even as he spoke, Aragorn felt a deep sense of unease over having to conceal Sloane's existence from Roran and Katrina. He knew the deception was necessary, but it still made him uncomfortable to lie to his family. For a moment, Aragorn considered telling Roran the truth, but then he remembered all the reasons he had decided not to, and held his tongue. Roran hesitated, his face troubled. Then he set his jaw and released Aragorn.
I trust you. That's what family is for, after all, eh?
Trust? That and killing each other?
Roran laughed and rubbed his nose with a thumb.
That too.
He rolled his thick, round shoulders and reached up to massage his right one, a habit he had fallen into since the Razak had bitten him.
I have another question.
Oh?
It is a boon. A favour I seek of you.
A wry smile touched his lips and he shrugged.
I never thought I would speak to you of this. You're younger than I. You've barely reached your manhood, and you're my cousin to boot.
Speak of what? Stop beating around the bush.
Of marriage, said Roran, and lifted his chin. Will you marry Katrina and me?
It would please me if you would,
and while I have refrained from mentioning it to her until I had your answer, I know Katrina would be honoured and delighted if you would consent to join us as man and wife.
Astonished, Aragorn was at a loss for words.
At last he managed to stammer, Me?
Then he hastened to say, I would be happy to do it, of course, but me?
Is that really what you want? I'm sure Nasawada would agree to marry the two of you. You could have King Orin, a real king. He would leap at the chance to preside over the ceremony if it would help him earn my favor. I want you, Aragorn, said Rohan, and clapped him on the shoulder. You are a rider, and you are the only other living person who shares my blood. Murtagh does not count. I cannot think of anyone else I would rather have tie the knot around my wrist and hers. Then, said Aragorn, I shall. The air whooshed out of him as Rohan embraced him and squeezed with all of his prodigious strength. He gasped slightly when Rohan released him, and then, once his breath had returned, said, When? Nasawada has a mission planned for me. I don't know what it is yet, but I'm guessing it will keep me busy for some time. So, maybe early next month, if events allow? Roran's shoulders bunched and knotted. He shook his head like a bull sweeping its horns through a clump of brambles. What about the day after tomorrow?
So soon? Isn't that rushing it a bit? There would hardly be any time to prepare. People will think it's unseemly.
Roran's shoulders rose, and the veins on his hands bulged as he opened and closed his fists. It can't wait. If we're not married and quick, the old women will have something far more interesting to gossip about than my impatience. Do you understand? It took Aragorn a moment to grasp Roran's meaning, but once he did, Aragorn could not stop a broad smile from spreading across his face.
Roran's going to be a father, he thought.
Still smiling, he said, I think so. The day after tomorrow it is. Aragorn grunted as Rohan hugged him again, pounding him on the back. With some difficulty, he freed himself. Grinning, Rohan said, I am in your debt. Thank you. Now I must go share the news with Katrina, and we must do what we can to ready a wedding feast. I will let you know the exact hour once we decide on it.
That sounds fine.
Rohan began walking toward the tent. Then he spun around and threw his arms out in the air as if he would gather the entire world to his breast.
Aragorn! I'm going to be married!
With a laugh, Aragorn waved his hand.
Go on, you fool. She's waiting for you.
Aragorn climbed onto Saphira as the flaps of the tent closed over Rohan. Blodgam! He called. Quiet as a shadow, the elf glided into the light, his yellow eyes glowing like coals.
Saphira and I are going to fly for a little while. We'll meet you at my tent.
Shade Slayer, said Blodgarm, and tilted his head.
Then Saphira raised her massive wings, ran forward 3 steps, and launched herself over the rows of tents, battering them with wind as she flapped hard and fast. The movements of her body beneath him shook Aragorn, and he gripped the spike in front of him for support. Saphira spiraled upward above the twinkling camp until it was an inconsequential patch of light, dwarfed by the dark landscape that surrounded it. There she remained, floating between the heavens and the earth, and all was silent. Aragorn lay his head on her neck and stared up at the glittering band of dust that spanned the sky.
Rest if you want, little one,
said Saphira.
I shall not let you fall.
And he rested, and visions beset him of a circular stone city that stood in the center of an endless plain, and of a small girl who wandered among the narrow, winding alleys within, and who sang a haunting melody. And the night wore on toward morning. Intersecting Sagas. It was just after dawn, and Aragorn was sitting on his cot oiling his mail hauberk, when one of the Vardan's archers came to him and begged him to heal his wife, who was suffering from a malignant tumor. Even though he was supposed to be at Nasawada's pavilion in less than an hour, Aragorn agreed and accompanied the man to his tent. Aragorn found his wife much weakened from the growth, and it took all of his skill to extract the insidious tendrils from her flesh. The effort left him tired, but he was pleased that he was able to save the woman from a long and painful death. Afterward, Aragorn rejoined Saphira outside of the archer's tent and stood with her for a few minutes, rubbing the muscles near the base of her neck. Humming, Saphira flicked her sinuous tail and twisted her head and shoulders so that he had better access to her smooth-plated underside. She said,
"While you were occupied in there, other petitioners came to seek an audience with you, but Blodgarm and his ilk turned them away, for their requests were not urgent."
"Is that so?" He dug his fingers under the edge of one of her large neck scales, scratching even harder. "Perhaps I should emulate Nasawada."
"How so?"
"On the sixth day of every week, from morning until noon, she grants an audience to everyone who wishes to bring requests or disputes before her. I could do the same."
"I like the idea," said Saphira. "Only you will have to be careful that you do not expend too much of your energy on people's demands. We must be ready to fight the Empire at a moment's notice."
She pushed her neck against his hand, humming even louder.
"I need a sword," Aragorn said.
"Then get one."
Aragorn continued to scratch her until she pulled away and said,
"You will be late for Nasawada unless you hurry."
Together, they started toward the center of the camp and Nasawada's pavilion. It was less than a quarter of a mile away, so Saphira walked with him instead of soaring among the clouds as she had before. About 100 feet from the pavilion, they chanced upon Angela, the herbalist. She was kneeling between two tents, pointing at a square of leather draped across a low, flat rock. On the leather lay a jumbled pile of finger-length bones, branded with a different symbol on each facet, the knuckle bones of a dragon, with which she had read Aragorn's future in Tirm. Opposite Angela sat a tall woman with broad shoulders, tanned, weather-beaten skin, black hair braided in a long, thick rope down her back, and a face that was still handsome, despite the hard lines that the years had carved around her mouth. She wore a russet dress that had been made for a shorter woman. Her wrists stuck out several inches from the ends of her sleeves. She had tied a strip of dark cloth around each wrist, but the strip on the left had loosened and slipped toward her elbow. Aragorn saw thick layers of scars where it had been. They were the sort of scars one could only get from the constant chafing of manacles. At some point, he realized, she had been captured by her enemies, and she had fought until she had torn open her wrists to the bone, if her scars were anything to judge by. He wondered whether she had been a criminal or a slave, and he felt his countenance darken as he considered the thought of someone being so cruel as to allow such harm to befall a prisoner under his control, even if it was self-inflicted. Next to the woman was a serious-looking teenage girl, just entering into the full bloom of her adult beauty. The muscles of her forearms were unusually large, as if she had been an apprentice to a smith or a swordsman, which was highly improbable for a girl, no matter how strong she might be. Angela had just finished saying something to the woman and her companion, when Aragorn and Saphira halted behind the curly-haired witch. With a single motion, Angela gathered up the knuckle bones in the leather square and tucked them under the yellow sash at her waist. Standing, she flashed Aragorn and Saphira a brilliant smile.
"My, you both have the most impeccable sense of timing. You always seem to turn up whenever the drop spindle of fate begins to spin."
"The drop spindle of fate?" questioned Aragorn. She shrugged.
"What? You can't expect brilliance all the time, not even from me."
She gestured at the two strangers, who had also stood, and said,
"Aragorn, will you consent to give them your blessing? They have endured many dangers, and a hard road yet lies before them. I'm sure they would appreciate whatever protection the benediction of a dragon rider may convey."
Aragorn hesitated. He knew that Angela rarely cast the dragon bones for the people who sought her services, usually only for those whom Solombum deigned to speak with, as such a prognostication was no false act of magic, but rather a true foretelling that could reveal the mysteries of the future. That Angela had chosen to do this for the handsome woman with the scars on her wrists and the teenage girl with the forearms of a swordfighter told him they were people of note. People who had had, and would have, important roles in shaping the Alagazia to be. As if to confirm his suspicions, he spotted Solombum in his usual form of a cat with large tufted ears, lurking behind the corner of a nearby tent, watching the proceedings with enigmatic yellow eyes. And yet Aragorn still hesitated, haunted by the memory of the first and last blessing he had bestowed. How, because of his relative unfamiliarity with the ancient language, he had distorted the life of an innocent child.
"Saphira?" he asked.
Her tail whipped through the air.
"Do not be so reluctant. You have learned from your mistake, and you shall not make it again. Why then should you withhold your blessing from those who may benefit from it? Bless them, I say, and do it properly this time."
"What are your names?" he asked.
"If it please you, Shadeslayer," said the tall, black-haired woman with the hint of an accent he could not place. "Names have power, and we would prefer ours remain unknown." She kept her gaze angled slightly downward, but her tone was firm and unyielding. The girl uttered a small gasp, as if shocked by the woman's effrontery. Aragorn nodded, neither upset nor surprised, although the woman's reticence had piqued his curiosity even more. He would have liked to know their names, but they were not essential for what he was about to do. Pulling the glove off his right hand, he placed his palm on the middle of the woman's warm forehead. She flinched at the contact, but did not retreat. Her nostrils flared. The corners of her mouth thinned. A crease appeared between her eyebrows, and he felt her tremble, as if his touch pained her, and she were fighting the urge to knock aside his arm. In the background, Aragorn was vaguely aware of Blodgarm stalking closer, ready to pounce on the woman should she prove to be hostile. Disconcerted by her reaction, Aragorn broached the barrier in his mind, immersed himself in the flow of magic, and with the full power of the ancient language, said, "Atra gulie un ilion tother ono un atra ono, weise scholaro fra rauter." By imbuing the phrase with energy as he would the words of a spell, he ensured that it would shape the course of events and thereby improve the woman's lot in life. He was careful to limit the amount of energy he transferred into the blessing, for unless he put checks on it, a spell of that sort would feed off his body until it absorbed all of his vitality, leaving him an empty husk. Despite his caution, the drop in his strength was more than he expected. His vision dimmed and his legs wobbled and threatened to collapse underneath him. A moment later, he recovered. It was with a sense of relief that he lifted his hand from the woman's brow, a sentiment that she seemed to share, for she stepped back and rubbed her arms. She looked to him like a person trying to cleanse herself of some foul substance. Moving on, Aragorn repeated the procedure with the teenage girl. Her face widened as he released the spell, as if she could feel it becoming part of her body. She curtsied.
"Thank you, Shadeslayer. We are in your debt. I hope that you succeed in defeating Galbatorix and the Empire."
She turned to leave, but stopped when Saphira snorted and snaked her head past Aragorn and Angela, so she loomed above the two women. Bending her neck, Saphira breathed first upon the face of the older woman, and then upon the face of the younger, and projecting her thoughts with such force as to overwhelm all but the thickest defences, for she and Aragorn had noticed that the black-haired woman had a well-armoured mind. She said,
"Good hunting, O wild ones! May the wind rise under your wings, may the sun always be at your backs, and may you catch your prey napping. And, Wolf Eyes, I hope that when you find the one who left your paws in his traps, you do not kill him too quickly.
Both women stiffened when Saphira began to speak. Afterward, the elder clapped her fists against her chest and said,